from UALR Public Radio and the Argenta Arts Foundation. This is Tales from the South, recorded in front of a live audience at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas. Each week, it's an intimate dinner with everyday Southerners on our unrehearsed show, telling their story as if they were sitting on the porch with you. So sit back, relax, and reconnect with the power of a story. Now, let's go live to Tales from the South.
Tonight's music by the Salty Dogs. Do I like the Salty Dogs? As Jason Ringenberg of Jason and the Scorchers said about the Salty Dogs, it's good, hardcore, salt-of-the-earth country, something very rare in these slick times. More can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to a very special edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tonight, we are on the road, on location, on our first outdoor show at the beautiful Bernice Garden in the Soma District of downtown Little Rock. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by the Arkansas Local Food Network with dinner by Boulevard Bread Company. And I'm your host, Paula Morell. On my left here strumming is 1931 National Resonator is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark played on legendary bluesman John Weston's CDs, Got to Deal with the Blues and Blues at Daybreak. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These genuine screen doors from the Arkansas Delta with mixed media portraiture are by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? This week's stories are all about local food and gardening and the way rich soil yields rich lives. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Sandra Spotts Hamilton welcomes the rain in her father's garden and will end the night with Josh Harden as he spies something from his own farm on someone else's truck. But let's start the night with Mary Elaine Lester as she stares in disbelief at her father doing something he's never done before in A Bountiful Backyard.
I don't know what did it. It may have been the nonstop snowing or the endless freezing temperatures, or maybe that it was one of the worst winters on record the year we moved up north from Texas. But that spring, my dad had just about had enough of Nebraska and began to extract payment for all that snow he had shoveled. Maybe it was his Depression-era upbringing, but he plowed 90% of the backyard and began to plant a garden. I'd only seen gardens in other people's yards, never in ours. I was 8 years old, and I was mesmerized. 6 months earlier, my mother pulled me aside to have a talk I'm sure she dreaded. "We're moving to Nebraska to be with your father," she said as she smoothed the front of her dress with her hands. "Your father's giving up his family practice in Shamrock and going to school to be a different kind of doctor, an orthopedist, a bone doctor. This may mean that, you know, we have to watch our pennies for a while, but we're going to make it. I was stunned. How could we be moving from Shamrock in the Texas Panhandle, where the wind always blew our worries away, to some cold place I'd never heard of? To me, Shamrock was falling asleep during the sermons in our cinder block church in the lap of a loved one, going with my father to the hospital on rounds, making A's in school and having fun chasing horned toads at recess. My dad came from a cardboard in your shoes survival childhood. Dad always valued education. No one can take away what you have in your head, he always told me. People told him he couldn't afford to go to medical school, but he did. And now he was going a second time. Since we hadn't joined my father yet, I thought maybe, somehow, we might be able to stay in the only home I had ever known. I loved my backyard, climbing trees, hide and seek, making forts. I couldn't wait for spring so I could literally dive in and get lost in the purple flowers and the oh-so-sweet smell of my own lilac bush. Mother's voice broke through my daydreaming. We will be moving at Christmas. I want you to know ahead of time so you can begin to say your goodbyes. But we can't leave. I won't know who my teacher is. Who will come to my birthday parties? And where will we go to church? I started to cry. My mother put her arm around me. I looked up at her, still pleading my case. Dad can make it by himself. Besides, we get to talk to him on the telephone every night. We will still see him, and he'll be coming home for a long time at Thanksgiving. My second grade mind quickly calculated the emotional math. Yes, sweetheart, but your father wants his family with him. My mother had played the trump card. We'll come back to Shamrock to visit. Cheer up. He'll be calling any minute. My life changed with that conversation. As my mother instructed, I said my goodbyes, collected as many hugs as I could, banked up memories in case Nebraska was awful. Despite all my wishes for it not to be so, my family headed up the road north in our Oldsmobile Delta 88 with all that we owned in the U-Haul right behind us. It was snowing as we pulled up to our red brick split-level house. At least we have a new house. It snowed and snowed, and it seemed as soon as my dad shoveled off the driveway, the snow fell again. He was turning into a human snowplow. I felt sorry for him. My father was not a complainer, but he started calling our new address Lincoln in the Sorry State. In our family album, a picture proves that Lincoln really was in the Sorry State. My mother took the picture of her bundled up, freezing cold brood, surrounded by the snow my father had shoveled. The snow was now taller than my dad. And then the spring finally came. My dad plowed up all that snow and began to plant a garden, a garden. I watched from the window as my father staked out rows, planted corn, beans, peppers, lettuce, sweet potatoes, squash, tomatoes, lots of tomatoes. And we planted okra. You couldn't buy okra in the stores in Lincoln, and Southerners just can't survive without okra. I got to plant a few seeds, but my job, my command performance, as my mother would say, was to help her in the kitchen. I set the table every night and would clear the dishes. After supper, my determined dad would go back and work in the garden, tilling, weeding, and fertilizing until dark. Before long, green sprouts started lining up to say, "Hello." I saw the packages my father had left marking the rows. I could translate what those green sprouts were going to be. Every day, I would run out to see how much my green friends had grown. Surprisingly, Lincoln, in the sorry state, started to change. The glorious garden began giving us gifts. My father picked the colorful vegetables, and my mother's cooking transformed them. In every Nebraska memory of my mother, she is wearing an apron and serving the family she loves. Her scented kitchen invited us to delights such as Salisbury steak, mashed potatoes, and right out of the garden green beans. The delicious smell still lingers. We feasted on salads with fresh lettuce, tomatoes, and onions. I couldn't wait for her southern fried chicken, made even more special with corn on the cob, tomatoes, and okra, given up by the Nebraska earth. I always looked forward to my personal favorite, my mother's meatloaf, served with candied carrots and summer squash from our bountiful backyard garden. Meal after meal, all our vegetables came from the garden. My mother had always been a wonderful cook, but somehow, with these magical Nebraska-grown vegetables, she seemed to spin straw into gold. We dined like kings and queens. Mom did more than cook at the stove. Wearing her apron, she spent hours canning vegetables from the garden. I never saw any cans, but lots of glass jars with brass lids in an enormous navy pan belching steam. After she turned off the stove and the jars cooled, she would walk them to the basement. Houses in Nebraska have basements. Houses in Texas have storm cellars. My mother watched our pennies without talking about them. But I knew things had changed. When we went to the grocery store, we only bought eggs, meat, bread, cheese, and milk. The garden gave us everything else we ate. Our treat for the week, when we went grocery shopping, was to ride the mechanical pony for a nickel. We didn't go to the beauty shop anymore. Mom gave my sister and me permanent waves while we sat on the kitchen stool. I have crooked bangs in my Nebraska school pictures. The next winter, my mother brought her jars of vegetables up from the basement, and we ate from a garden we could no longer see. We delighted in garden-rich meals while the Nebraska snow fell. That black Nebraska dirt had given back to us, but not without a fight. Slowly, I began to like my new school and my teacher. The new girl who moved in next door became one of my best friends ever. I even got used to the snow. I would wear my snow suit and carry my lunchbox with a thermos filled with hot chocolate and walk a mile to school, crunching snow under my boots all along the way. I can still hear the sound. I didn't realize it then, but the garden and my parents' never-give-up attitude had given me limitless strength for the adventures of my lifetime. I now knew I could leave home and follow my dreams. Like my father, years later, I did just that. I left my safe teaching job in Arkansas and adventured to film school on the East Coast. I would survive just as my family had. After all, I could always plant a garden. Even to this day, putting my hands in the dirt and planting seeds gives me great joy. I carry in my heart through the winter the expectation of spring. Never far away are the memories of not so terrible Nebraska and our bountiful backyard garden.
Mary Elaine Lester, a career mathematics instructor, currently reaches rural Arkansas via distance learning. A professional actress, experienced in theater, film, and commercials, Mary dedicates this story to her sweet mama Dale, her first cheerleader. In our next story, the rain is coming as Sandra Spots Hamilton watches her father tend the soil in Fertile Ground.
The last of the day's sun rays reach their fingers through the remaining clouds to rest their tips on the newly turned black dirt in my father's garden in our backyard in Little Rock, Arkansas. The scent of earthy smoke from the neighbor's burning leaves floated into the patch like incense. I watched as Daddy dug with his turning fork turning up a juicy worm already spotted by the robin loitering a few feet away. I wiggled my bare toes into the moist black soil until they disappeared, then wiggled them back to the surface. Sister sifted through the newly turned dirt, sorting the exposed rocks, keeping the pretty ones to edge the flower bed. "Look here, Shorty. Know what these are?" "No," I replied, eyeing the cluster of white ovals Daddy had scooped onto the fork. "They're terrapin eggs. We'll bury them again and they'll hatch into babies." He gently laid down the clump that held the eggs and carved out a hole and put the eggs back to bed, away from the row. Sister and I poked the onion sets into the row near the patch of turnips Daddy planted, just in case, although he hated the taste. Childhood memories of an empty belly had taught him that lesson. There were two cotton plants at the rear of the turnip patch. In later years, I would understand that he planted these as a reminder to himself to remember the hard life of the cotton fields in his youth and to appreciate his white-collar career. Although he didn't talk much about those days, I later knew that growing up as a tenant farmer's son had taught him two things. Be grateful for what you have, even though it may be little, and always prepare. I walked the furrows Daddy had plowed, where soon he would plant corn, tomatoes, squash, okra, and pole beans that would feed us throughout the year. For a moment, the furrow had become my imaginary tightrope as I fancied myself a circus performer. At the end of the row, I met Daddy just in time to grab his leg as I lost my balance. He rested his hands on the turning fork, gazing at a mound in the garden's southeast corner. His brow seemed to carry furrows as deep as those he had plowed. "What's that, Daddy?" I asked. "That's the remains of a deer I shot last fall. That's where the venison in the freezer came from. Hunted all my life, never had it happen before, but this one likes to come back in my dreams. Guess he likes to remind me to be grateful." He gazed upward at the approaching rain clouds. I reached into the fence row and picked a dandelion flower and placed it on the smaller mound marked by a large flat rock. I knew this was the resting place of Floppy, our English setter, the world's most patient dog, who allowed her girls to dress her in mother's cast-off clothes, including purse and hat. I pointed to another mound. "Is that Fur Man, Daddy? Can he meow down there?" "I reckon he can, Shorty. I reckon he can. Let's get these tools back under the porch. Looks like we might get a little shower," Daddy said. Sister and I complied, washed our hands with cool water at the faucet, and climbed the steps to the back porch as the screen door snapped behind us. We squealed, startled by a clap of thunder. At the top of the stairs, the pungent aroma of stewed tomatoes greeted us. Mother had canned dozens of quarts from last summer's harvest, and they had helped feed us all year. Daddy slid through the screen door, peeling off his wide-brimmed hat with one hand while the other mopped his neck with his handkerchief. He turned back toward the garden and looked up at the sky. He stood just a few feet from Sister and me, and we took a step forward, and I touched Daddy's hand. He looked down at me and back outside. Then he began his ritual planting season chant as the thunder rolled. "Come on, rain," he yelled to the heavens, his voice thundering like the sky. Sister and I giggled, huddling safely behind him. "Come on, rain," we all yelled, holding our hands out to catch the cool, wet gift as it sprayed through the screen. I took in the heady smell of the rain on freshly turned soil, the smell that never fails to remind me that in that garden, on that day, I learned the essential lesson of life, how this soil began the cycle of life with those terrapin eggs and plant seeds, sustained us with the food it and my father's labor would yield, and then graciously received the remains when life was complete.
Sandra Spots Hamilton is a writer and designer who is a native of Little Rock, Arkansas. She graduated from the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville with a degree in art and a minor in English. In our final story of the night, we move from backyard gardens to a farmer's market as Josh Harden gets ready for another day selling his wares,
Unbeknownst to him, there's trouble brewing in the Jesseville Slugger.
It all began on the gravel parking lot at the YMCA on a hot July morning, 2009. I'm a fifth-generation farmer, market farmer in Arkansas, and during the average season, our two family farms supply an abundance of traditional fruits and vegetables to our local community. My father's specialties include sweet corn, watermelons, cantaloupe, peas, and a long list of traditional southern favorites that no market should be without. My own small-scale farm, organic farm, produces the more diverse crops such as fingerling potatoes, odd varieties of squash, heirloom tomatoes, flowers, and assortment of herbs. And on this day, we had just set up at the village market with our family-grown specialties ready to go. The sweet corn was piled high, melons cut, stacked perfectly, bouquets neatly arranged, and the overall energy particularly high because the weather was actually going in the favor of the farmer for a change. But the energy would soon change. Soon after our arrival, an unfamiliar vendor began to unload his wares. As he began to unload melons, corn, Florida tomatoes, bananas, waxed cucumbers, and a plethora of imported Texas produce, it hit me this guy was a customer of our own family truck patch. You see, in Arkansas, it's pretty customary for retired old men to find wholesale farms and rejected loads of grocery store food and load down their pickups in search of tax-free income. During the peak summer season, you can find any number of these guys sitting on the side of the road with their own brand of handmade signs which scream, "I'm authentic and obviously a farmer because I have a truck with food in it." On this day, however, the place was not a roadside. It was a farmer's market. And the fella was not only in violation of the principal market rule, grow what you sell, but he also had a truckload of our family's signature crop of 710 watermelons. And this melon could single-handedly convert even the biggest critic of non-Hope or non-Cave City watermelons. And I had happened to spend the last few weeks hucking these 40-pound average monsters across the 50-acre patch to fetch the $3 to $4 bill offered on the wholesale market. So seeing him on my market turf startled me. Though I felt some sort of strange loyalty to this older gentleman who happened to be without a shirt and donning a well-worn but perfectly stiff cowboy hat, I knew I had to make it clear that this was a direct violation of our bylaws. You see, this was a new type of farmer's market, the type where you have to be a farmer to be at the market. And though this seems like a simple idea, it's often not a farmer or a producer at all on the other side of the table. And there are plenty of curbsides and gravel patches where such a clearly colorful fella could make a buck or two. But for a creative, educated young agrarian, there is no motivation to sit on the side of the road, and the farmer's market is critical. So the first approach was from the manager. As the market manager, who was also a farmer, much more burly than myself and about a foot taller, explained the infraction to the shirtless gentleman, he became clearly agitated and quickly flew out of the parking lot in a cloud of rocks and dust with his fist waving in the air, announcing he would return with his kinfolk. After about 45 minutes, he and another two members of the now three self-proclaimed Jesseville locals. And not only had they returned with more family, but they had also brought baseball bats. So the farmer's market was full of customers and life, and we were full speed selling fresh food as fast as we could as the mob rolled in ready to go to war with what they saw as outsiders. So how do you defuse this situation without losing money, reputation, and body parts? Well, we did what any level-headed farmers would. We smiled and continued to try and conduct business as usual. But passivity wouldn't pacify these three. Oh, no. They came for confrontation, and they were hell-bent on getting it. So someone phoned the police as one of the sons pulled a bat from the truck and approached the market manager. We were all calm. And as I sized the disheveled bunch up, I saw there was only one shirt between them. I quickly stepped up and said, "Please just go, don't cause a scene." And right as I finished the last word of the sentence, I caught a right hook from the other youngster. And the market came to a complete stop. An elderly woman got pushed back by the kid and several people jumped in as I realized what had happened. For the first time in my life, I stood up to the peddler, my arch nemesis as a market farmer. And now I just got sucker punched for it. So luckily the police arrived in the chaos and diffused the situation to the point where business resumed, customers started purchasing food again, and I declined to press charges, only under the condition that these troublemakers move on from our market. And they did, all of 50 feet away, where they spent the next 3 hours making faces and taking various articles of clothing off to show us their muscles and rebel flag tattoos. And it was on that hot gravel parking lot in 2009 that I realized that the fight is much bigger than I ever thought. I realized that to take back the markets in the name of the family farm and the small farm, that we need to have family farms and small farms to participate. And as I handed fruit from our family soil to a grateful customer, I made a promise to myself to remain committed to keeping farmers' markets about farmers, and to remind people to buy locally as much and as often as they could. And as I caught a glimpse across the parking lot of yet another rebel flag tattoo on pasty white flesh, I promised to remind people to always be sure they're buying from a bona fide producer. Thank you.
Josh Harden is an organic farmer in Sheridan, Arkansas. The family farm, Harden Farms, is located in Grady and where he has spent many of his adult years. He holds associate's degrees in agroecology and diesel mechanics and is currently working on a BA degree in agricultural education at the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. In addition to farming and studying, he is also the state field coordinator for the Society of St. Andrews, where he helps coordinate volunteer and inmate labor to glean unmarketable food from Arkansas farms. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our riders. Thank you to our live audience here on the road at Bernice Garden in the Soma District of downtown Little Rock. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week back at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. Studio time by Infrared Studio Productions. Graphics by Robin Steves at Studio B. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.